Small is the gate and narrow the path that leads to life. Hello, Philadelphia. You're tuned in to The Narrow Path with teacher and scholar Steve Gregg on Heritage News Talk, WWDB. Over 2,000 years ago, a Jewish carpenter stood up against the powers that be and said and did things that changed the course of human history. Today, Steve will open up the phone lines to address what you would like to know about what was said and did in the Bible. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you about what it takes.
Radio program hosted by Steve Gregg. Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be able to be taken. In the place of the usual format, we've put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. In addition to the radio program, The Narrow Path has a website you can go to, www.thenarrowpath.com, where you can find hundreds of resources that can all be downloaded for free. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to Steve Gregg and The Narrow Path.
Our first caller today is Richard, calling from Seal Beach, California. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve, I often hear you mention the tribulation years in some of your answers. Now, do you believe there's really 7 years of tribulation, or did the 70th week of Daniel happen right after the 69th week, in your opinion? And I will hang up and listen to you on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Now, the 70th week of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 9, provides the only reason anyone has ever found for saying there's a seven-year tribulation. There's no mention in the Bible of a seven-year tribulation anywhere. There is mention of tribulation. Jesus mentioned there will be great tribulation in Matthew 24:21, and also Revelation 7:14 mentions these are coming up out of the great tribulation. But when the Bible mentions the great tribulation, which it only does a couple of times, it doesn't ever mention how long it is. And the idea that we have a seven-year tribulation to look forward to comes from the assumption that the 70th week of Daniel is still future. Now, if you don't know about the 70 weeks of Daniel, I can't go in detail about it because it's very complicated, but it's in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27. A period of 70 sevens is mentioned, from one starting point to an ending point. Now, the ending point is apparently during the lifetime of the Messiah, or at least it says that 69 of these sevens, and most scholars agree that these sevens mean periods of 7 years, that 69 of these sevens transpired when Jesus came, and that there's one more seven that follows the 69. Now, it's popularly taught by dispensationalists that the 70th week of Daniel was postponed, that the 69th week ran its course, found its end in the ministry of Jesus, or actually at the crucifixion of Jesus. And the 70th week was postponed until the end of the world. And so, sometime in our future, they say, there will be the 70th week of Daniel. Now, these 70 weeks of Daniel are 7 years each. And so it is the assumption that the 70th week of Daniel is the same thing that Jesus spoke of as the Great Tribulation that has led some people to say there's a seven-year tribulation. And that's where we get that. Now, the question was, do I believe the 70th week of Daniel was postponed, or did it happen immediately after the first 69 weeks? Well, given simply the principle of literal interpretation, I would find no reason for that postponement. Daniel was told there'd be 70 sevens. That's 490 years from one point in time to another point in time. He did not say that it'd be 483 years until one point in time, and then a 2,000-year gap, and then 7 years more. The whole period of time was said to be 490 years. Now, that 490 years, whenever it began, was in Daniel's time, or shortly thereafter, or maybe even before. It was depending on whether it was Cyrus's decree or Artaxerxes' decree. Different people measure from different starting points. But the point here is, whichever point you started from, you've still have got that period of time has run out a long time ago. So we don't have a future 70th week unless there's been some kind of an unmentioned gap between the 69th and 70th week, which I say unmentioned. Nowhere in Scripture suggests that there would be such a gap. In fact, in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, the whole period of 70 weeks is broken down into three parts. It mentions 7 weeks, then 62 weeks, then 1 week. So that makes 70. 7 plus 62 plus 1 makes 70. Now, nobody has ever suggested that there's a gap between the first 7 and the next 62 weeks. Everybody sees those as running consecutively. They call that 69 weeks, although it says 7 weeks and 62 weeks. No one has ever suggested a gap between those two portions. And yet some think that there should be a gap between the 69th and the 70th week, which is not hinted at in any way in the passage. And that being so, I don't believe there is that gap. Now, I do believe the tribulation that Jesus spoke of is related to the thing he was talking about in Matthew 24. He had predicted in the beginning of Matthew 24 that Jerusalem would be destroyed and not one stone of the temple would be left standing on another. This actually happened within 40 years of his utterance. The Romans destroyed Jerusalem. The disciples came to him and asked, when would this be? And he answered them. And in the midst of answering them, he said, there will be great tribulation. And he said, and this generation will not pass until all these things are fulfilled. So great tribulation that Jesus spoke of seemed to be related to what happened to the Jews during the war between themselves and the Romans. And if anyone wants to read the history in Josephus, they'll see that it certainly was horrendous what the Jews went through in that period of time. If you look at the parallel from Matthew 24, look at it in Luke 21 and verse 21 and 22 and so forth. Instead of saying there will be great tribulation, it says there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. So it's talking about Israel and the people there, the distress and the wrath that came upon them when Rome conquered their city and their commonwealth and destroyed them. So I don't see anything in Jesus' words that would place the tribulation as 7 years, nor necessarily as future from our perspective. He said it would happen in that generation. That's how I understand it. Now, there's different ways that generation is understood by different people. And I have, in my own past, understood it different ways when I was myself a dispensationalist. But essentially, when I began to read the passage in its context without too much influence from my dispensational teachers and my dispensational assumptions, I actually saw it somewhat differently, and I do now. So I think the 70th week occurred immediately after the 69th week, as one would expect. That'd be my position on it, and of course, many of our listeners would think otherwise. So let's talk to Manuel from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Manuel. Welcome.
Hello, Steve. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah.
I have a question regarding to, by the way, to Matthew chapter 7, and I think you mentioned it earlier. I have that chapter read to us at the congregation, and I think as you are saying that some preachers have their own interpretation, and probably you have your own, and I have my own, and so it's kind of sometimes confusing.
Okay.
But anyways, this time I heard, you remember Matthew chapter 7 said, not all that call me Lord will enter into the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
And because I never knew you. And our pastor in our congregation said exactly, one of your lectures mentioned that too, that we need to know Jesus Christ intimately. And I agree on that we need to know Jesus Christ. But he also mentioned that people that go to visit people in the hospitals or even that scene in the church, they will end up in hell. And but I think that chapter 7 should read all together with Matthew 25 that one of you just mentioned earlier too. And because you just say I can read there that people that go visit prisoners or they're gonna be separated on the judgment day for as the goats and the lambs. So what is your interpretation exactly? They should be read together those chapters 7 and 25 when you mentioned one of them.
Well, I mentioned them together, but they can be read together or separately. I don't know that one explains the other. If that's what you're asking.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if we were to say that one of them explains the other one, then we'd probably be saying, well, the person that Jesus is warning us not to be in chapter 7 is the same as the goats that we are being warned not to be in chapter 25. I'm not sure that that is the case, but it could be. Certainly the problem in both cases is a failure to do the right thing. In the case of Matthew 7:21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does my Father in heaven. So doing the will of the Father is seen as the necessary thing in Matthew 7:21. Likewise, in the story of the sheep and the goats, doing the right thing is helping the Christians when they're poor and naked and hungry is the right thing to do. That's doing the will of the Father. And failing to help them is, of course, failing to do the will of the Father. So you could say that the goats certainly fall into the category of those that Jesus is talking about in verse 21 of Matthew 7.
Yeah, but the fact that if you give a glass of water to a person, it's compared to healing someone in the name of the Lord is comparatively minor. I mean, I assume that a person that heals someone in the name or casts demons in the name of the Lord is more has more intimacy with God than the one that just give a glass of water.
I understand. In other words, in Matthew 7, it goes on to say, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonders in your name? And I will say to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. And yet, in Matthew 10, just three chapters later, Jesus says if someone just gives a cup of cold water to a disciple in the name of a disciple, that he will not lose his reward. I've always assumed that the persons in Matthew 7 who prophesied and cast out demons and so forth were doing it for some other thing, other motivation than just pleasing the Lord. It doesn't say what their motivation was, but they are contrasted with those who do the will of the Father. You know, they say, Lord, Lord, but they don't do the will of the Father. Now, you might think, well, isn't casting out demons and prophesying and doing wonders, isn't that the will of the Father? Well, if that's what the Father has you do, it would be. But it's also possible to be neglecting the things the Father really wants you to do, like loving your neighbor. Loving your neighbor is the chief commandment. Jesus said, this is a commandment I give you, that you love one another. All men will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. So the person who gives a cup of cold water for the right reasons is fulfilling the command to love. The person who prophesies may or may not be loving. Remember what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13. He says, if I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge and do not have love, it profits me nothing. So Paul suggested that it's possible to prophesy and not have love. He also said, if I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. So Jesus pictures people who can work wonders. Certainly moving a mountain would work a wonder. Prophesy and even cast out demons, which it is peculiar to think that a person who maybe isn't a real Christian could actually cast demons out. But we do know that that is the case because there's a place in Luke where it says that the disciples came to Jesus and said they found some men who were not walking with them, were not part of the disciples' group, who were casting out demons in Jesus' name. So apparently there are cases of people who cast out demons in the name of Jesus but who are not themselves Christians and who prophesy but are not Christians and who even do signs and wonders and are not Christians. The main thing that makes you demonstrate that you're a Christian is that you love one another. And Jesus said, greater love has no man than this, but that he lay down his life for his friends. So the story of the Good Samaritan is given as an illustration of love your neighbor as you love yourself. So helping somebody who's in need, it's not as spectacular as casting demons out or prophesying, you know, before a group or doing signs and wonders. But I think Jesus is saying that the spectacular things are not necessarily the things that show that you're really a godly person. What shows that you are a true disciple of Jesus is that you love.
Yeah, that's exactly what my conclusion is. Just exactly as you described, that it's love what makes you that makes a difference. And Jesus Christ Himself said, "This is the proof that you are my disciples if you love each other."
Right.
And it's something that loving another person, you cannot something that you you may cover it, but usually people that are genuine lovers, they show it.
Yeah, amen. Hey, I've got to take some more calls. I'm almost out of time, brother.
Yeah, thank you for answering my question. God bless you.
Thank you for your call, Manuel. All right, we'll talk next to Dana from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Dana. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello. How are you today, Steve?
Good, thanks.
I'm just going to ask the question, and then I'm going to have to get off the line and just listen to your response on the radio, if that's okay.
Okay.
My question to you is when do we cut the umbilical cord with our children? For instance, you know, I'm going through some stuff with my son. He's 19, and I know that he is a young man now. And he is making some poor choices in life that are very detrimental to him for the rest of his life. That could, you know, it could land him in prison. But uh-huh. I just feel a guilty feeling of having to save him. But I know I can't do that. And when do we cut that to just put him in the hands of God to allow God to do things for him and for him to be responsible for his actions?
All right. And you said you didn't want to stay on the line?
No, I'm going to go ahead and get off the line and listen to your response.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this is a hard question. I can't really say that I've had the best instincts about this myself with my five children. My five children are now grown, but young adults. And some of them have needed more help than others. In fact, virtually all of them have at one time or another needed some kind of financial help from me. Some of them have only needed it on rare occasions and in limited ways. And in many cases, of course, the financial problems they were in were due to choices that they had made, maybe choices I would not have made myself or would not have agreed with, but then they found themselves in need. You know, there are different parents who would give different answers. The Bible certainly doesn't give you an answer. There's not a biblical answer to saying when you would not help your children anymore or when you would require them to bear the brunt of their decisions. That is going to be a decision made by essentially a parenting style and also hopefully by parental wisdom. There are times, no doubt, when you should help your children because a little bit of help from you may actually save them a great deal of trouble and it may be good for them in the end. On the other hand, there are times when if they're counting on you to bail them out, you're just enabling them to continue living irresponsibly. And by helping them out, you're just preventing their growing up and becoming responsible adults. And that's where it's very difficult to make that call. I don't know of any specific answer. I don't know of, for example, I can say, well, at age so-and-so is the time. Because even if your children were 50 years old and you were 75, if the economy goes bad or something, they might be found homeless or whatever, and you could very easily feel that bringing them into your home would be a right thing to do, and I certainly wouldn't say it wouldn't be. Disaster can befall people at any age. You know, you kind of have to weigh it, like how much of this disaster did you bring on yourself, and to what extent are you willing to change the things in your life that brought the trouble? If you're not willing to change, then I don't think I'm going to sponsor your behavior. You know, that's really the issue. Parents, or for that matter, neighbors or church members, may often be called upon to assist other people, adults, who have fallen on hard times. And, of course, parents doing so for their children are the most likely persons to do it because they have a natural affection for their children. But really, helping the poor, helping the disadvantaged, is every Christian's responsibility, including that of parents. Though I do believe you need to use some discernment to say, well, okay, this need that my child has for my intervention is something that he or she has brought upon themselves by neglecting my counsel, by going away that I did not approve, and they knew it. And now look what's happened to them. Now, I can bail them out or not. And I would say you'd have to decide that on the basis of whether you, whether that, that child seems to be mending their ways or not. We find God is the ultimate parent in the Bible. And there are times when he says, you'll cry out to me and I won't hear you, you know, because you despise my counsel and my reproof. Therefore, you know, when your calamity comes, I'm going to turn my back on you and you're going to just feel the whole brunt of your actions. Sometimes God has done that. But at other times, people have been very irresponsible, fallen into great disaster, and they cried out to God and he delivered them when he didn't have to. There's not some kind of a rule book about this. It has more to do with the dynamics of how you're hoping to still act redemptively toward your children. And or anyone else for that matter, because it may not be your children who are in need. Maybe you've got a neighbor or a friend or someone in your church who's acted irresponsibly and they're in trouble and now they're looking to you or to the church for help. And once again, you've got to make those kind of decisions have to be made on the basis of wisdom and on the basis of, you know, what can I do that will ultimately be best for my child in this situation. And ultimately best may actually be something different that is than what seems immediately best. If your child goes to jail, it may be that that'll be the thing that reforms his behavior, whereas nothing else did. On the other hand, if your kid goes to jail, he may hook up with the wrong kind of people and become more embedded in a life of crime. It's really, really hard to know. And I would say that every parent in that situation has got to pray and ask God to give them wisdom. Because, I mean, I couldn't give you an answer unless the Bible just gave some kind of a straightforward answer. But I don't see some kind of a rule laid out in the Bible on this. I think this has to do with parental wisdom, has to do with principles. In your case, if your child is unrepentantly involved in illegal behavior, it might be good, especially if the legal consequences are relatively minor, like if he just goes to jail for a little while. You know, that might be good for him, might be corrective for him. And if it isn't, it's not your fault. You know, he's an adult. And if he actually goes worse off because he went to jail, it's not really your fault, though you'll probably have some regrets thinking, well, maybe I could have prevented this. Parents always have to live with that kind of question, or not always, but often have to raise the question, you know, is my child doing worse than they would have if I had done something differently? You can't go back and undo the things you've done. And once you've seen that you've actually made a mistake, you can always apologize to them and ask them to forgive you. But we're all experimental humans. We're experimental parents, especially. By the time we finish raising our kids, we might know something about what we should have done. But while we're raising them, we're full of questions about the things that we have to do right now. And it does seem strange, you know, that children are given to inexperienced parents. And we sometimes make mistakes and afterwards have to repent or apologize. But on the other hand, these are learning experiences for us as well. And I don't know how many children you have. Maybe you just have the one. Sometimes you'll make mistakes with an older child and learn lessons that'll make you a better parent with the younger ones, and that's too bad that the oldest child has to be the experimental one. But I would just say seek counsel of those who know your son's situation, maybe leaders of your church, maybe wise individuals in your circle, and just sense case by case whether this is a situation where your son needs to be bailed out or helped. And on what terms? You know, I mean, just bailing them out isn't necessarily going to help, but if you bail them out on certain conditions, say, okay, you do this, you change this, you change that, and then I'll help you. That would be the only way I would think it would be redemptive. Anyway, I wish I had a more firm answer about, you know, well, this is the age you stop helping. I don't think there's any age that you necessarily stop helping, depending on the cause of the crisis and the state of your child's mind in the situation. So you got to take those things into consideration, and then you'll sometimes decide one way, sometimes another. And sometimes you'll make the wrong decision and make a mistake, and then you'll have to repent, and you might have to do some damage control. That's kind of how life is, unfortunately. But we do have God with us. We do have God to give us wisdom, and if we don't hear him correctly when we make our initial decision, he can give us wisdom about how to how to respond later to fix things. It'd be nice if we were all just brilliant and knew exactly how to make these calls. Some people do seem to have more of an instinct about that than I do. I think I've probably made a mistake in that area a number of times with my kids. But other people, you know, seem to be a little wiser. Anyway, being wise is really the counsel I can give you. And being wise means taking all the factors into consideration that are pertinent and then making the decision that common sense would seem to justify. Wish I could be more helpful than that.
I only have about a minute before we're going to have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. We have some of our stations leave the network at the half-hour point. The program goes on for an hour, that is another half-hour. And if you are listening to a station that actually leaves the network at this point, you can hear the second half of the program by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where we stream the program live and we archive it for later. There's also a podcast, and there's also our internet, our telephone apps, which you can listen to the program all the way through on those apps. And they are free, so you might want to check those out. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and we pay for the radio time. We buy the time on the radio. There's no one paid at the Narrow Path. I'm a volunteer. Everyone's a volunteer. We got a lot of people who volunteer, but nobody gets paid a penny, and no one receives any benefits. But we do take the money that is given, and we give it to radio stations so that we can stay on the air, and that's what we do. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want to from our website, thenarrowpath.com. But thenarrowpath.com is a resource for you to take things for free. Everything is free there. Or you can donate at thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned. In about 30 seconds, we will be right back to continue the program for the second half hour.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Steve is not in the studio today, so calls from listeners will not be taken. In place of the usual format, we have put together some of the best calls from past programs. They cover a variety of topics important to anyone interested in the Bible and Christianity. And now, please enjoy this special collection of calls to The Narrow Path.
All right, we're going to talk next to Walt from Kaiser, Oregon. Walt, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I've got some questions about the Catholic Church.
Okay.
The first one regards the succession to Peter as Pope. When did they start doing that? And secondly, do they also select successors to the other apostles? And since James was apparently the last leader at Jerusalem, do they consider him in any way as a successor? And was there any record of any chosen by the apostles or the church to succeed James?
Well, that you raise a good point. And by the way, there's more than one James. James the apostle was killed in Acts chapter 12, and there is no evidence that they ever had a successor to him named in the apostolate. The James that you're talking about that was so dominant, prominent, he wasn't dominant, but he's prominent in the church in Jerusalem, that was James the Lord's brother, who was not even one of the 12, but he was regarded as an apostle nonetheless, because Paul refers to him as an apostle in Galatians chapter 1. So James, who was prominent as the leader of the Jerusalem church after Peter kind of moved along to other places, that James is not one of the 12, but he is an apostle. But did anyone succeed him? No, I don't think so. James was stoned to death by the Sanhedrin, I think around 64 A.D., if I'm not mistaken. And that's only 6 years before Jerusalem was destroyed. And by the way, 2 years after that, the war started, which was through the whole nation in chaos. if there was somebody who rose to succeed James at his death, that person could have only been involved for a very few years because the whole church fled from Jerusalem before 70 AD. So a successor to the church, the leadership of the Church of Jerusalem, would be a moot point. It may well be that somebody stepped into James's shoes. I don't have any evidence of it necessarily at my fingertips, but whether they did or not, it would be of short duration, and there'd be no one to follow that person because the Jerusalem church ceased to exist in 70 AD. They fled and lived elsewhere in different places. Now, as far as Peter's successor being the pope, you ask, do the other apostles have successors in Roman Catholic thinking? That's an interesting question. And from my conversations with Roman Catholics and my reading of their material, I think I can answer it. But if there's a Roman Catholic listening who sees it differently, they're certainly welcome to call and correct me. As I see it, that is, from talking to Roman Catholics, I see them saying that the bishops, the high-ranking bishops in the Roman Church, are the successors to the apostles in terms of authority. But only the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter. And since they believe Peter was over all the apostles, then the Bishop of Rome, who we call the Pope, or they call the Pope, is over all the other bishops of the churches. But they don't really specify that there are 11 other bishops who have special authority under the Pope and above all other bishops. Like there would be, for example, if when Thaddeus died, or when James the Less died, or Judas not Iscariot, or Thomas, when these men died, we never read of any successor being named to take their place. And many of the bishops of churches around the world in the first century were already bishops before the apostles died. So they weren't successors in the sense of, okay, the apostle died and left a vacancy and then this guy stepped in. No, there were bishops in all the churches, or most of the churches, in the lifetime of the apostles. So there's really nothing to suggest that being a bishop means you're a successor of an apostle. And I've never heard of the Roman Catholic Church ever naming any successor to Thomas or to Andrew or to Thaddeus or to some of these other lesser apostles. They only, to my knowledge, name a successor to Peter, and then they would just say the College of Bishops, all the bishops combined, are kind of like the apostolic group. So, to me, if this is truly the approach they take, and I think it is, then that would seem to raise questions about whether a specific successor to Peter is to be considered anything. Because if we just say, well, the bishops in general, however many thousands of them there may be around the world, are the successors to the apostolic group, then that would be a way of saying that no specific apostle left a specific successor. And if that's true of the other 11, why would we think that the specific apostle Peter left a specific successor? For us to simply say the leadership of the church in the second generation took over for the leadership that was abandoned by the apostles in their deaths. That doesn't mean that the next generation were considered apostles. It's simply that they were there to lead the church as the apostles had been there to lead the church, but not necessarily as apostles. In the New Testament, an apostle and a bishop were very different things. So anyway, I don't know if that answers your question.
One more. Peter, when did they start selecting someone who was the next pope?
Well, there is a list of all the bishops of Rome going back to Peter in the traditional church fathers' writings. For example, Eusebius, the church historian, has a list of all the bishops of Rome, assuming Peter to be the first, and then going from Peter on up to Eusebius's time, which was 325 A.D. Even then, there's no evidence that Eusebius thought that the successors of the bishops of Rome, that they were on a par with Peter for authority. And in other words, to say that the Church of Rome may have been led by Peter before he died, and we don't have any real, strong evidence that that is the case. For example, Paul came to Rome. Well, he wrote a letter to the church in Rome. And in the letter that he wrote to the Church of Rome, he sent greetings to scores, or I should say dozens, of people that he knew. There were Christians in Rome that he knew were there, and he was writing, and he sent greetings by name to all these different Christians. He doesn't send greetings to Peter, which would be very strange if Peter was, in fact, the leader of the church in Rome. Paul apparently didn't even know of Peter being in Rome at that time, much less being, the leader of the church there. Furthermore, when Paul came to Rome, which was 4 years after he wrote the letter, we don't read of him having any conference with Peter. We read of him, of Christians in Rome coming out to meet him. We read of him entertaining guests in his home while he was in Rome, but we don't read of him having any contact with Peter, nor do we read that Peter was ever even in Rome. Now, the traditions of the church say that Peter did go to Rome and that he did die there. But that he was ever the leader of the church, there's no evidence whatsoever except for these lists of bishops of Rome, which go back and have and they place Peter there at the beginning. So I'm going to say maybe Peter did go to Rome before he died. Well, he did. He died in Rome. But maybe he actually, you know, was there since he was an apostle, after all, and probably the only apostle in Rome before Paul got there. Maybe he was viewed in some sense as the supreme leader of the church or something in his lifetime. But after he died, there would be, of course, other leaders. And, you know, some of them are named. You have a succession of them going back to Peter in Eusebius. But there's no suggestion in Eusebius that the guy who moved into leadership when Peter died somehow had the same authority that Peter had, or that he was now the apostle over the church, or the papa of the church, the pope. There's no suggestion like that. So the fact that they can list a succession of the leaders of the church in Rome doesn't mean that they recognize successors to mean on the same level of authority as Peter. For example, Eusebius, who gives us that list, also gives us a complete list of the bishops in Antioch. And none of them were apostles, but he lists all the bishops of Antioch from the beginning of that church until his own day. And also, I think he does the same with Ephesus and some other churches. It's been a while now since I read Eusebius, but he does give successor lists from the original bishops of certain churches down to his own time, who is a bishop at that time. But he doesn't indicate that any of them, you know, were successors of any particular apostles. They were just a succession of church leaders. And so the idea that Peter then and his successors became what would be now recognized as popes was slow in developing. I don't think they had quite formulated that doctrine in the 4th century when Eusebius wrote. It was fairly firmly in place by the 7th century, by the time of Pope Gregory. Pretty much your typical papal traditions about the power of the pope were in place around the year 600 with Pope Gregory. But before that, it was a developing doctrine. You know, there were some people like Augustine around the year 400. He suggested that the bishops of the world should be subjected to the Bishop of Rome. But whether he was suggesting it as an opinion or stating what was like by his time an established view of the whole church, I don't know. If the view of Augustine was not innovated by Augustine, but he was stating something that was already recognized, then we would have to say the idea of the papal succession, the apostolic succession of the seat of Peter, may have developed sometime between Eusebius' time, which would be 325 AD, and Augustine's time, which would be about 400 AD. So somewhere in the last half of the 4th century, possibly.
Oh, yeah. That's very interesting, Steve. Thanks very much.
Okay, Walt, God bless you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye now.
Leanna from Norway wrote to me and said, "Hi, Steve, I'm trying to understand the circumstances surrounding the recording of the book of Job. First of all, was Job inspired by God to record his experiences? Otherwise, why else would he write his story?" She says, "Secondly, if the dialogues between Job and his friends seem more like lengthy dissertations rather than back-and-forth conversations, are they really true dialogues? Were these dialogues written as letters to each other, or were they actual face-to-face conversations? It seems as though it would be a difficult task to record such long conversations while in a state of extreme suffering? Lastly, how did Job know about the dealings in heaven with Satan and the angels of God? Well, Leanna, these are very hard questions to answer. We don't know really if Job wrote the book of Job. It is possible that he did. I'm open to that possibility, but the book of Job doesn't actually claim to be written by him, and therefore the author might be just about anybody. The story of Job, I believe, is a true story, and he is mentioned in the book of James as a good example for us all of enduring suffering for righteousness' sake. He's also mentioned very favorably in the book of Ezekiel, I believe, character, and I believe these things really happened to him. The book of Job is, however, in the class of literature called wisdom literature, and it's written in poetry. Except for the first two chapters, the book is written almost entirely in poetry. That section, which is poetry, is largely dialogue between Job and his three, or eventually four, friends. And either they spoke in poetry, or else somebody after the conversation took the gist of the conversations and created a poetic masterpiece from it, which is entirely possible. You know, Shakespeare took certain historical characters, Julius Caesar and King Richard and so forth, and he wrote poetic dramas based on the history. Some people feel that that may be what Job is, that Job may not have written the book, but it is about his true experiences. And somebody who either witnessed these conversations or was somehow otherwise apprised of them set them in poetic form as we have them now. This is one theory. Another theory is that these conversations really were spoken in poetry. We know that the prophets of Israel spoke in poetry. We have record of that in the prophetic books. And it's possible that these speeches were not just delivered in rapid succession one to another. It may be that these remarks were very much prepared before each man spoke. We don't know how much time elapsed between Job speaking the first time and his first friend speaking to him, and then how much time elapsed between that and Job answering him. We know these people were not in a hurry because his friends came and they sat silently for 7 days before any of them spoke. And that means that they were, you know, contemplating what they would say, no doubt. And they may have had those kinds of intervals between their speeches as well, for all we know. The exact time that elapsed is not told us. But if Job wrote it, he no doubt wrote it afterwards, and he was a good poet. If somebody else wrote it, they may have simply taken the gist of the speeches and given us a poetic rendering of the same ideas that these people spoke. You asked, how would Job have known, anyone have known, about the dealings between God and Satan and the angels in heaven, which we read about in chapters 2 of Job? And I would say the only way that could be known would be by prophetic revelation. And so whoever wrote it apparently was a prophet. And that he might have seen a vision of this to let him know would be not unthinkable. We have actually another case in 1 Kings chapter 22 of a prophet named Micaiah who saw a vision in heaven of God conversing with the angels and even of an evil spirit, a lying spirit coming up and presenting the suggestion that he could go and become a lying spirit in the mouth of Ahab's prophets, and God saying, yeah, let's go ahead, do that. In other words, this interaction between God and the angels was actually seen in a vision by this prophet Micaiah in 1 Kings chapter 22. It's possible that whoever wrote Job, being a prophet, also had a vision of those things, and that may be how he knew about them. However, we're not really told. There are a number of mysteries about the writing of the book of Job, exactly who wrote it, how long it was written after the events, whether the speeches are verbatim speeches as they were uttered or poetic digest of what was actually said. These things we can't answer with certainty, but I'm simply mentioning things that are possibilities, and those are, to my mind, possible answers to your questions. Good questions, though. All right, let's talk to Nick from North Hollywood. Nick, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. God bless you.
Thank you.
I was going over, Matthew, your teachings, verse by verse. By the way, for your listeners, the topical lectures you have are just so great that I learned so much. But there's so many gems you have that, you know, people need to know in verse by verse teaching. The other day I was listening to Matthew 19, and I think you have it sectioned every 22 minutes. And it was, yeah. I think it was the second one. And you had me, I don't know, crying for joy after what you explained about the happiness of a Christian. And it's really about the happiness of God, not us. And it made so much sense to me. It was like, I really needed to hear that. And it was just unbelievable. I don't know if you remember it, but I wish you would even comment a little more about this topic because it made so much sense.
Well, I don't remember what I said in that lecture. I gave those lectures more than 15 years ago. And you know, I don't have standard things that I always say about a passage, so I'm not sure what I said on that occasion. I usually speak as I feel led to speak on these verses. Can you remind me of something that I said that you're referring to?
Well, you actually, this is what I love about your teachings, because you go on tangents like Paul does,
yeah.
And it was so enriching. What happens is, and I don't even remember the verses. I remember you went on for like 10 minutes that, you know, so many people, so many Christians claim that you should be happy, but it's not really about our happiness. It's about pleasing God and making God happy, and sometimes it doesn't mean our happiness when we please God. You know, it could be a little hurtful or not so pleasant.
Okay.
And I found that enlightening.
Well, maybe I was talking about marriage and divorce, because that's in Matthew 19 begins with the discussion of divorce. And perhaps I was,
yes,
pointing out that Jesus does not grant us the right to divorce simply because we're unhappy in the marriage. And a lot of people do seek happiness in marriage. In fact, sometimes they get married simply because they think it'll make them happy, or that the person will make them happy, which is generally not a safe thing to assume, because if you're not happy already in the Lord, then it's not likely that any human being can consistently make you happy. There may be people who can please you somewhat, but that's not the same thing as being happy. Happiness is found in having a right relationship with God, being, you know, having a clear conscience, knowing that you're pleasing God, loving God enough that His pleasure is worth more to you than yours. And that's where happiness comes from. The Bible does not say that we should be pursuing happiness, although, of course, our Declaration of Independence says we have the right to pursue happiness. But actually, as Christians, our goal is to pursue the will of God, to pursue holiness, to pursue God's pleasure, not our own. However, once we make the decision to do that, we find the paradox that we truly are fulfilled and happy when we have stopped being concerned about our own happiness and when we seek to do what God has made us to do. And that's partly because we were made to have this kind of relationship of pleasing God. And when we're not doing it, we're trying to find this fulfillment somewhere else. And frankly, nothing else is made to fill that gap. So anyway, I have no idea really what I said in that lecture, because I haven't heard it for a long time. But I would say that a lot of times people feel like, well, why would God make me stay in a marriage where I'm not happy? Well, maybe He wants you to learn how to be happy in His will. Certainly, there's a greater basis for happiness in knowing that you are pleasing your Creator, in knowing that you are being faithful to your commitments, than there is from simply having someone always trying to make you happy. People have limits to how much they can make you happy, and therefore, if you're expecting them to, they will inevitably disappoint. But happiness comes from somewhere else. It comes from doing the will of God and delighting in it because you love God. All right, Nick. Well, I appreciate your recommendation of that lecture. And by the way, I agree with you. Those lectures on Matthew are pretty good. They are the only lectures at my website that are as short as they're. They're 22 minutes long, because I went through Matthew over the course of a year for a radio program that was a half hour long, and we left time at the beginning and end for announcements and so forth. So the teaching portion was only 22 minutes long. Most of our lectures at the website are 90 minutes, or at least 60 minutes long. But the Matthew lectures, there was no rush to get through. There's 200 of them. I think there's 200 of them, 200 lectures through Matthew, which is like 71 hours or something like that. Anyway, because I was in no rush to get through, I did go off on tangents. Of course, I do that even when I am in a rush. But anyway, I think there were some, I've gotten good comments about that particular series. I appreciate you calling, and I'm glad it's blessing you. Let's talk to, by the way, folks who don't know, our website is thenarrowpath.com, and all my lectures are there. You can listen to them for free. You can download them for free. Nothing is for sale there at thenarrowpath.com.
Let's talk to Art from Los Angeles next. Art, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Again, Steve, thanks for taking my call. First of all, I want to make a comment on me. I wish I had a meeting up here for us out here in the South Bay, you know, Gardena, Torrance area. So maybe one of the days you're going to have one.
I'd be glad to. I'll tell you what, I basically just wait to be invited. If somebody wants to invite me to hold a meeting there, I'll try it and see if we get some people coming out.
Let me try to work on it. Okay. But anyhow, my question right now, I just hear you about this situation you had. Somebody asked a question about children, you know, going to heaven, you know, what's going on with that. But you make a very interesting comment out there. You started out with, okay, we are all born sinners, okay? Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, from that point on, then there is not much wiggling time. In other words, whether God will accept these particular, you know, things, but we may not have an immediate answer on, you know, may deal with that. But as being a sinner born, you know, that has to be undone first. And I don't see that nowhere, you know. So, we can hope it happens, of course, because we're looking at a humanity way, you know, to children, you know, they're very vulnerable and they cannot have their own thoughts yet. But still, we have that burden, the unfortunate burden of inherited sin. But you know, I just want to make the comment on you that I have a little bit, kind of difficulty myself with this. But I do believe God will have an answer on that. We do not know yet at this point. But yet we have to sometimes face the reality that this, you know, God is sometimes not logic. That's the way I look at it. It's painful, but we are born sinners. And how do we undo that? And if you look
we're going to run out of time here. So let me see if I can give you my thoughts on that. It is true, I think, that we're born sinners. But then Christians still sin too, unfortunately, and we are forgiven. And the gospel is that Jesus came to die for the sins of the world. Now, we have to ask, well, if Jesus died for the sins of the world, then why isn't everybody in the world saved? And the answer, I think, is given by Jesus in John chapter 3 and verse 19. He says, "This is the condemnation, that light has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil." So Jesus said, the reason men are condemned, and this is even in spite of the fact that Jesus came and died for the sins of the world, the reason people still are condemned is because light comes to them, and they love darkness instead, and they reject the light. And as I understand it, when a person rejects the light that they receive, that's when they actually come under the condemnation. Despite the fact that Jesus died for their sins, there's little else God can do for them, I think, if they reject his light, if they reject what he offers. Now, a child before a certain age doesn't have light, that is spiritual light. They don't have insight into spiritual things. They receive it at some point in their development as children. They do come to the point where they have spiritual light. I don't know what age that is at, but it's certain that a newborn baby doesn't have any spiritual insight. And therefore, they haven't rejected it. If they haven't had any light, they've not rejected it. And I believe that the blood of Jesus covers the sins of the world. But the problem is that everybody comes to a point in their early life where they receive light and reject it. And then that is the basis. Jesus said that's why they're condemned. Not because they're born condemned or hated by God or anything like that, but because they reach a point where light comes to their world and they reject it. So I believe children who are before that point in time in their lives where they've received light or rejected it are under the blood of Jesus, and just like you and I are.
You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. As I mentioned earlier, we're listener-supported. We pay for the time on radio stations. We're on quite a few stations, and it costs a lot of money. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website, but everything at the website is free. It's thenarrowpath.com. And I hope you'll join us again. We'll talk some more. God bless you.